Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Yes, after Kipper the Cat on these Tuesday evenings and after the 2 minutes of newslets, it's Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson and you can get in touch with me at lamplight@cambridge105.co.uk. I invite you to attend. There are lots of stories for us tonight, little bits of gruesome but fascinating scenes, not only from Dante's Inferno, but from Greek myths as well. So come along. Last time, you remember, we attended with Dante to the plight of the hypocrites, painfully shuffling along in an endless and pointless circle, really beautiful and impressive with their ornamented cloaks on the outside, but weighed down almost beyond endurance because these very same cloaks are made of lead. Try carrying even a little bit of lead and you'll soon see how heavy it can become. And as well as those hypocrites, we saw Caiaphas, crucified in the dirt, across the pathway so that every weighted-down hypocrite must stomp on him when going past, representing the subset of hypocrisy that we can call expediency, the act of doing what you know is wrong in order to gain some short-term benefit, no matter how worthy that benefit might seem. Letting the ends justify the means, and that's wrong. Dante and Virgil discover now that the bridge they'd been told was up ahead has collapsed, just like all the other bridges over this ditch. Virgil, the representative of reason, is mortified at having believed the demon Malacoda when he told them this bridge would be operable. Not only that, but one of the hypocrites that they had been talking to had taunted Virgil for his gullibility. Dante's alarmed at Virgil's disturbed mood right now, but not for long. Now look, Canto 24 begins with a remarkable image, taking us far away from the dark and painful regions of hell, back to the bright world up here, to a peaceful pastoral scene. Under the sign of Aquarius, that is January 21st to February 21st, the shepherd wakes up and looks outside to see the whole landscape white with frost. The whole place is frozen up. How is he going to feed his sheep? His provisions in the shed have run low, and he needs to take the sheep out to pasture, but he can't if it's all frozen. The shepherd slaps his thigh, apparently a traditional gesture of frustrated impatience, and goes back inside, where he paces back and forth, not knowing what to do. In his restlessness, he goes outside again, just to check, and discovers that il mondo aver cangiato faccia in poco d'ora. The world has changed its face in that short time. The late winter sun has been strong enough to melt the frost, and the fields are green again. Nothing to worry about after all. The shepherd picks up his crook and leads his sheep out to feed for another day. That's a pretty long little story. And then Dante gets to his point. In just such a way, he felt dismayed to see Virgil's dark mood, but that mood disappeared very quickly, and Dante's faith in his leader was restored. And so they can move further on. Little darling, I feel that ice is slowly melting. Here comes the sun. Well, that was the version from the Beatles' album Love. George and Giles Martin mixing together three of George Harrison's songs, Within You, Without You, Here Comes the Sun, and A Bit of the Inner Light, to produce a new track. This transformation of different objects into a new form will reappear as the predominant motif in the episode we'll be looking at this evening under lamplight. But meanwhile, the song can just accompany Dante's pastoral image of the shepherd, relieved to see the sun melting the frost, illustrating Dante's relief at seeing Virgil's angry face quickly restored to its usual intelligent calm. But of course, this being a poem in which all details carry meanings on many levels, this image tells us more. Dante is about to show us his images of thievery, that state of the soul when, rather than doing good work and earning your own living, you steal from others to enrich yourself. But in this pastoral image, we see the shepherd dutifully concerned with his flock, frustrated because he thinks at first that they won't be able to get enough food for the day, but then happily leading them off to pasture. Not only, then, is he taking responsibility for feeding others, the sheep, but also at the same time providing for himself, building up the flock that will provide him with an income from their wool, their milk, and ultimately, no doubt, their meat and their skin. This is a world of mutual service, even at the humblest level. No need to steal here. So why should anyone want to be a thief? Why should anyone want to be a thief? And instead of helping others, why should they take from others? Well, this is the big eternal question, isn't it? Well, this section of hell is all about losing or being restored to your right identity. And so now we see Virgil restored to his right mind, to his proper identity as the guide for Dante. And as soon as he is restored to his right mind, immediately he tackles the problem of how the two of them will get out of that ditch. He discovers a pile of rubble from the collapsed bridge and helps Dante with the exhausting climb up to the next ridge. Virgil, the good shepherd here, helps Dante, and Dante, although completely exhausted, puts on a good face and pretends that he's not as breathless as he really is by this point. And so they continue on to the next ditch, crossing over the bridge. Dante hears a voice crying out, someone moving along down below, trying to speak words, but as though unable to articulate human speech. Master, Dante says to Virgil, can't we go over to the other side of this bridge, where we'll be closer to what's going on down there? From up here I can hear and see nothing. And so they climb down from the bridge to the other side. E poi me fu la bolgia manifesta, and then the ditch was exposed to my view. Let's walk over and see what Dante discovers. E vidi vi entro terribile stipa di serpenti, Dante says. And looking down into that pit, I saw a dreadful swarm of serpents. They were worse, Dante tells us, than all those legendary serpents in North Africa. Caelidri, whose track smokes as it glides along, the flying jaculae, Pharae, digging a trench behind them with their tail, Sentkers, moving in a straight line on their spotted bellies, and the two-headed Amphisbaena, strange names for strange creatures we know only through legend. Here it's worse than those legends, and it's not just simply snakes, but a whole assortment of snake-like serpentine creatures. So Dante stands up there above, watching these creatures swarming all over, and the sinners, naked, of course, and terrified, as who wouldn't be, running around aimlessly, instinctively looking for some kind of protection, but of course finding none. There's nowhere to hide. And they're even more vulnerable to attack from the serpents because their hands are tied behind their backs. And it's not so simple as that. Their hands are not tied with rope or anything inanimate like that. No, they have snakes wrapped around their wrists, and then the snake's head and tail wriggle between the sinner's legs and knot themselves in front. This is gruesome, but what makes it even worse is the perception that the snakes keep writhing around with a kind of perverted phallic aggression being carried out in front of these guys. It's a kind of... All right, I'm about to get a bit vulgar. The snakeheads around these guys' groins is a kind of literal enactment of the one-eyed trouser snake of Australian song. You know what I mean? You remember The Adventures of Barry McKenzie? Did Barry Humphreys write that song? I suppose so, but I don't know for sure. But anyway, here he is singing it.
I've got a little creature, I suppose you'd call him a pet. But if there's something wrong with him, I don't have to call a vet. He goes everywhere that I go, whether sleeping or awake. God help me if I ever lost me little one-eyed trouser snake. One day I got to reading in an old Sky Pilot's book about two Starker's bastards who made the Lord go crook. It reckoned it was a serpent that made Eve the apple take. Cripes, that was no flaming serpent, Adam's one-eyed trouser snake. I met an arty sheila I've never met before, and something kind of told me that she banged like a shithouse door. She said, come up and see your etchings. Yes, I hope they're not a fake. I said, the only thing that's etching is me one-eyed trouser snake.
The one-eyed trouser snake, a nice little pet, but you don't take him to the vet. So much for the smutty snake jokes for this evening. But back to this seventh bulger in the Inferno. This is the ditch where the thieves reenact their sin in their own surreal fashion. Do we need to explain what theft is? Surely not. It's quite simple. Theft is taking something that doesn't belong to you, that belongs to someone else, and usually by some kind of fraudulent practice, hiding what I'm doing from both you and from the authorities, taking it for my own. But here's where Dante's concept of this sin differs from ours. In Dante's time, as in ancient Rome, property was regarded as part of a person's identity. My jacket belongs to me in the same way, I suppose, as my nose or my chin belongs to me or my voice. And that concept puts a whole new level to our choice of clothes. We wear clothes not to feel comfortable, but to declare our identity. We still see this fairly often in our society, but much more casually than in other cultures. And so, if you steal someone's property, you are also stealing a part of that person's identity. Steal my jacket and you are impersonating me. It's an odd way of looking at things, but logical in its own way, right? We need to understand this in order to understand what happens to these thieves, who paid no regard to personal identity, but felt free to take on others' possessions and identities, and, I suppose, giving up their own to some extent when they assumed the other person's identity. Here in hell, therefore, they are constantly giving up their identity in the very physical form of losing their bodies, which the snakes have the power to transform into something other than their original shape and identity. And suddenly, as Dante has his eye on one of these figures running madly all around the place, suddenly a serpent shoots up and bites this guy from behind, right where the neck and shoulders join. In an instant, this figure flashes up in flames, is entirely consumed by the fire, and turns into a pile of ashes on the ground. In an instant, quick as that. But then what do you think? Those ashes, still smoldering, we presume, start coming together in the next instant of their own accord and rise up into a kind of pillar, and suddenly this man is right there again, in his original shape. It takes him a little longer to come to his senses, though, and he looks blankly around him, sighing, aware that something very strange has happened to him, but having no idea what. Virgil calls down to this man and asks him who he is. It takes him a little bit to get to his identity. Understandably, he's still recollecting himself. He says first that he rained down here from Tuscany not long ago. He says he preferred the life of a beast to a human life, suggesting that he lived just for himself, with no rational control, just like a mule, as he puts it. And then finally he identifies himself. Son Vanni Fucci, bestia. I'm Vanni Fucci, the beast. And beast was, in fact, Vanni Fucci's nickname, as one of the contemporary writers tells us. Because he was so bestial, he was called Vanni the Beast. This puzzles Dante because, as he explains to Virgil, he knew about Vanni Fucci, who didn't. But he knew of him as a man of violence and anger, not as a thief. What's he doing in this part of hell? Vanni Fucci hears him and looks right at Dante and then blushes in shame, as much as one of them could blush or feel shame. And he gives his long testimony. It's more painful to me, he says, to have you recognize me down here than it was for me at the moment of my death. But I can't refuse to tell you what you want to know. You'll understand anyway sooner or later. I'm here with the thieves because, well, you remember that big heist of the treasure in the cathedral in Pistoia? You remember that this other guy, also called Vanni, was hanged for the crime? Well, actually, it was me who stole the treasure, and I framed him. But, and here Vanni reveals his real nastiness, but just so you don't feel too happy to see me here in this place, let me tell you some news. Your party back in Florence is going to be wiped out by my party, like a bolt of lightning coming down from the clouds, destroying every one of you white Guelphs. And, he concludes, and I've told you this because I know it will grieve you down to your very core. And that's the end of Canto 24. We have to wait till the opening of the next canto for the conclusion of this encounter with Vanni Fucci. He's presumably not one of those whose hands are bound by snakes, because he raises both his hands in an obscene gesture to the heavens. Togli Dio, gate la squadro. Take that, God, this is for you. After that, Dante says, the serpents were my friends, as they attacked this bitter man, one snake wrapping itself around his neck to keep him from saying anything more, another coiled around his arms and another around his chest so he can't make obscene gestures to God. And so, moving only his legs, he runs off out of our story.
Down your turn. you know that you're stealing a thing that you can. Temptation stands just behind that door. So what you wanna go and open it for? I'm a thief till I dig it. I'm gonna be, I'm gonna bring it. I'm a thief till I dig it.
Oh, Jawbone, when did you first go wrong? Oh, Jawbone, where is it you belong? A three-time loser, you'll never learn. Put down your tools before you burn. You keep on running and hiding your face, spreading your heat all over the place. But he says, I'm a thief, and I dig it. He's a modern Vanni Fucci from the band's second album. Well, no sooner has Vanni Fucci run off than someone else comes onto the scene. This is Cacus, whom Dante describes as a centaur, but unlike the other centaurs who are functionaries of hell, looking after the river of blood in the circle of violence, Cacus is actually one of the condemned, a suffering soul in hell, down at this place because he had stolen the cattle of Hercules. Now he comes galloping up, his back, the animal part, covered in snakes, and up on his human shoulders there sits a dragon with wings spread, breathing fire. Cacus is shouting, where is that unripe soul? Perhaps meaning Vanni Fucci, who perhaps has run off so quickly to avoid pursuit. Not seeing his prey here, Cacus runs off. And now the next show appears. This time it involves three new sinners who call out to Virgil asking where one of their comrades, Gianfa, has gone. But before anyone can respond to this, something very strange occurs. Dante stops the narrative to say that it's no wonder if we don't believe what he's about to describe, since he who actually saw it could hardly believe his own eyes. What happens? I don't want to describe it myself. Dante has to do it himself. Here's the Hollander's translation. While I stood staring with raised brows, a reptile with six legs propelled itself at one of them and fastened itself to him. It grabbed his belly with its middle claws, then with its forepaws held his arms and bit him on both cheeks. It stretched its hind feet down the other's thighs, thrusting his tail between them and curled it up behind above the buttocks. Never did clinging ivy fix itself so tight upon a tree as did that fearsome beast entwine itself around the other's limbs. Then they fused together as if made of molten wax, mixing their colors so that neither seemed what it had been before. The other two were looking on, and each was shouting, "Oh, my Agnello, how you change! Look, now you're neither two nor one." Already the two heads had been united, two sets of features blending, both lost in a single face. Four separate limbs combined to form two arms. The thighs and calves, the stomach and the chest turned into members never seen before. All trace of their first aspect was erased, and the unnatural figure seemed both two and none, and lumbered off at its slow pace. Thank you. And so that horrendous, unnatural figure, both two and none, both human and reptilian, lumbers off at its slow pace. This Agnello was, we're told, the Florentine Agnello de Brunelleschi, of whom an early Italian writer has this to say. Even as a boy, he used to empty the purses of his father and mother. Later, he would empty the strong box in the shop and steal other things. Then, as an adult, he broke into other people's houses, and he would dress like a pauper and wear the beard of an old man. In other words, not only did he steal other people's possessions, and thus, as we've said, their identities too, but he altered his own identity. It's no accident that Dante has him lose himself altogether in this episode. He no longer has any control over his identity. But that reminds me, we need to pause for a station identification right about now. So here it is. You are listening to Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105 as we attend to Dante in the circle of hell devoted to thieves, people who take others' possessions, and with that, others' identities, too.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
Thank you. Now, remember, there were three souls standing there below where Dante and Virgil were watching. One of them, whose name we learn was Agnello, had that transformative encounter with the six-legged reptile. What about the other two? Well, just as soon as the transformed Agnello lumbers off, suddenly out darts un serpentello acceso, livido e nero come grande Pepe, a little fiery reptile, black and livid as a peppercorn. This serpentello darts up and bites one of the two men standing there, bites him right in the navel, the place, Dante says, where we are first nourished. But this is a kind of anti-nourishment, as we'll see. The serpentello then jumps back to the ground, staring up at the man. And the man stares back, saying nothing. It's like he's in shock, but then, unexpectedly, he yawns, as if, Dante says, as if deep sleep or fever had assailed him. And as the two of them, not moving, keep staring at each other, a little distance apart, dense smoke starts pouring out from the wound in the man's navel and from the little serpent's mouth, and the smoke comes together between them and merges into one cloud. Dante, holding his story in suspense, stops for a minute, stops, in fact, to brag that what he's about to describe outdoes any of the fantastic transformations depicted in the works of the ancient master Ovid. Ovid was known as the master writer of scenes of transformations, which occur every few pages in his long poem Metamorphoses. The description we've just seen, in which two figures each lose their identity and merge into one new figure, was Dante's attempt to go one better than Ovid's description of the transformation of Salmasis and Hermaphroditus. Here, let me tell you the story, briefly, of Salmasis and Hermaphroditus, as Ovid relates it. We need some background before we get to the actual metamorphosis. Hermaphroditus was the son of Hermes and Aphrodite, and he was beautiful. Salmasis was a water nymph who loved to spend her time bathing her lovely limbs, as Ovid puts it, and combing her hair and checking how it looked, using the pools of water as her mirrors. One day she was lying on the soft green grass in a gauzy dress, gathering flowers, and looked up to see Hermaphroditus wandering towards her, and knew immediately that this was her heart's desire. But she was enough of a little flirt to pause a minute and check her dress and adjust her hair and make her eyes sparkle. And she made the first move, basically saying, "Oh, you must be a god, fair boy, you're so beautiful. That woman who is your wife must be really blessed, if you have a wife. And if you do have a wife, let me steal you from her for a while. Or if you have no wife, let me be your wife." In other words, I have the hots for you, boy. Let's do it right now. Ovid never hesitates to point out how hot sexual desire can spring up at any time, in an instant, in anyone. Hermaphroditus, still an inexperienced young man, blushed at these words, but his blushes made him look even more gorgeous. And he backed away while she pressed him further and started to put her arms around his neck. "Stop that," he cried, or if you don't, I'm going to run away from here right now." "Okay," she said, have it your way. I'll leave you alone here." And she walked off, but not too far, and hid behind some bushes. Now Hermaphroditus, thinking he was alone now, came over to the refreshing waters of the pool and, stripping off his clothes, got ready to plunge in. You can imagine how much hotter Salmacis became when she saw him naked there. As Ovid says, her eyes blazed bright as when the sun's unclouded orb shines dazzling in a mirror. The boy slapped his palms against his thighs and dove into the water, swimming with wet arms glistening in the sun. And she could hold herself back no longer. He was now in the water, and she was, after all, a water nymph. This was her element. "I've won! He's mine!" she cried out, and pulling off her clothes as she ran to the water, she took a mighty dive far out into the pool and grabbed the swimming boy. But he still resisted, and she still persisted. Here's Ovid again. As he struggled, she forced her kisses, willy-nilly fondled him, caressed him, now on one side, now on the other, clung to him as he fought to escape her hold, and so at last entwined him. She wrapped her arms and legs around him, and the more he fought, the tighter she clung. "Fool," she said, "fight me as you will, you'll not escape. Oh, you gods, ordain no day shall ever dawn to part us two." And the gods heard her. And here's the moment of transformation when the two of them will never be parted. Here's Ovid continuing in Melville's translation. "Both bodies merged in one, both blended in one form and face. They two were two no more, nor man nor woman. One body then that neither seemed, and both." And what did this new body look like exactly? Ovid leaves it to our imagination, but we have taken over the name, haven't we, to describe those people who are born with both male and female characteristics, hermaphrodites. Dante knew his Ovid very well, and knew his readers did too, and would be comparing Aniello's merging identity with Hermaphroditus and Salmacis merging. And we all will, Dante knows, surely acknowledge that Dante's description goes one better than Ovid's.
That dream so real. One can talk about being in love.
Two can say how it really feels.
One can worship on a star.
Two can make that wish come true, yeah.
One can stand alone in the dark.
Two can make the light shine through.
It takes two, baby. It takes two, baby. Me and you. Just take two. It takes two, baby. It takes two, baby. Make a dream come true. Just take two. One can have a broken heart, living in misery.
Two can really ease the pain like a perfect remedy.
Be alone in a car like an island, he's all alone.
Two can make it just an inner place, seem just like a big.
Marvin Gaye and Kim Weston, It Takes Two. See, they think it takes two to make a dream come true, but they don't realize the chances they take of having a complete merging. It takes two to turn into one new body. There's another transformation in Ovid that is relevant here for what is about to happen, and Dante alludes to it, the transformation of Cadmus, who was so miserable about his fate, which involved enormous pain and disappointment, we needn't go into here. He left the city of Thebes that he'd built himself, and as he walked out of the city with his beloved wife, he made a rash wish that he might be a snake stretched along the ground, if that's what it would take for the gods to help him in his misery. Be careful how you talk like that, especially if you're a character in Ovid's Metamorphoses. I'll now continue in Ovid's words. Even as he spoke, he was a snake that stretched along the ground. Over his coarsened skin, he felt scales form and bluish markings spot his blackened body. Prone upon his breast, he fell. His legs were joined, and gradually they tapered to a long, smooth, pointed tail. He still had arms. The arms he had, he stretched, and as his tears poured down still human cheeks, "Come, darling wife," he cried, "my poor, poor wife, touch me while something still is left of me, and take my hand while there's a hand to take, before the whole of me becomes a snake." More had he meant to say, but suddenly his tongue was split in two, words failed his will, and every time he struggled to protest, he hissed. That was the voice that nature left. That's the end of the transformation story, but Ovid continues the tale, and it's too endearing for me to stop now. Here's what happens next. Beating her naked breast, his wife cried out, "Stay, Cadmus, stay! Throw off that monstrous shape! Cadmus, what now? Your feet, your shoulders, hands, where are they? And your color and your shape, and while I'm speaking, everything! Oh, you gods, why don't you turn me into a snake, too?" He licked his poor wife's cheeks and glided down to her dear breasts, as if familiar there, and coiled, embracing, around the neck he knew. All who were there, and courtiers were there, all were terrified. But she caressed and stroked her crested dragon's long, sleek neck. And then suddenly there were two, their coils entwined. They crawled for cover to a copse nearby, and still what they once were they keep in mind, quiet snakes that neither shun nor harm mankind. So that was the story of Cadmus and Harmonia, still devoted to each other, and wasn't that touching? Still devoted to each other in their old age, even though their world had collapsed around them, changed magically into snakes together. But we have to return to that scene in Hell, where we left the thief standing there in a stupor after being bitten in the navel by the little serpent, smoke coming out of his wound and the serpent's mouth mixing together between them. And here's how Dante goes on. Remember, Dante has just bragged that no one has ever dared a description like this. The reptile split its tail into a fork, and he that was wounded drew his feet together. First his calves and then his thighs began to knit so that in but a moment no sign of a division could be seen. The cloven tail assumes the shapes the other one was losing, and his skin was turning soft while the other's hardened. I saw the man's arms shrinking towards the armpits and the brute's four paws, which had been short, lengthen precisely as the others dwindled. Then the hind paws, twisting together, became the member that a man conceals, and from his own the wretch had grown two paws. While the smoke veils one and now the other with new colour and grows hair here and elsewhere strips it off, one of them rose to his feet, the other fell, but neither turns aside his baleful glare under which each muzzle changed its shape. In the one erect, it shrank into the temples, and from the excess flesh absorbed, two ears extruded from smooth cheeks. Whatever did not recede, left over from that excess, made a nose for the face and gave the lips a proper thickness. The one prone on the ground shoves out his snout and draws his ears into his head as a snail draws in its horns. And his tongue, till now a single thing and fit for speech, divides, and the other's forked tongue joins, and the smoke stops. The soul just now become a brute takes flight, hissing through the hollow, and the other, by way of speaking, spits after him. Did you follow that transformation scene? No, probably not. It becomes confusing. What's changing in which of the creatures? Well, of course it's confusing. The whole concept is based on confusion, a confusion of identity, just as theft is founded on the confusion between what is mine and what is yours. But you get the general gist of the changes. The man's arms shrink down to little lizard arms, while the serpent's forepaws enlarge into arms, and the faces change in both directions at the same time. And the odd thing is the way Dante chooses to have the man's legs fuse together to form the tail, and, as Dante puts it, the member that a man conceals then splits and forms the lizard back paws and vice versa for the serpent. And as the man now lizard scampers off, the serpent now man turns to the other man standing there and says, "Now let him run around the place on four little legs as I've had to do. Spiteful nastiness at every step around here." And that's where the episode ends, and where our evening under lamplight ends too. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, probably the most fantastic in the whole inferno. But next time, we'll have two fascinating confessions from sinners at the next ditch. Come back then. And so this is Robert Louis Abrahamson thanking you for attending Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105. We've had enough of this hell for a bit. Let's, for a moment, try to get to heaven before they close the door, like some exclusive club closing up for the night.
Rumbling in the skies. I've been wading through the high muddy water with the heat rising in my eyes. Every day your memory grows dimmer. It doesn't haunt me like it did before. I've been walking through the middle of nowhere, trying to get to heaven before they close the door. When I was in Missouri, they would not let me be. I had to leave there in a hurry. I only saw what they let me see. You broke a up the book and not write anymore. I've been walking that lonesome valley, trying to get to heaven before they close the door. People on the platforms waiting for the trains. I can hear their hearts swinging on chains. When you think that you've lost everything, you find out you can always lose a little more. I'm just going down the road feeling bad, trying to get to heaven before they close the door. Relive my
hollow as it seems. Some trades don't pull no gamblers, no midline ramblers like they did before. I've been to Sugar Town, I shook the sugar down. Now I'm trying to get to heaven before they close the door.